Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned, and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. Today's episode is with Caitlin Ugolik Phillips, the author of the amazing book, The Future of Feeling: How to Build Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Right now, in a world of uncertainty and stress, people are getting very emotional and can fly off unexpectedly. I've witnessed more arguments between friends in WhatsApp groups lately than ever before. So now, more than ever, it is important to build empathy and trust, to think of others and their backstory before blaming them or saying potentially offensive things. We need to be respecting each other and remembering that there's a human behind the text we see, and that we want to help with problems instead of making them worse. So I'm very happy to be talking with Caitlin today about her work and journey into researching these things and her mission to build more empathy as we connect online. It's very important now and for our future in a tech-obsessed world. I haven't addressed the COVID-19 situation on the podcast here yet, as I've been getting through the backlog and also building an app, but I do want to do some specific ways we can grow our mindsets and learn from the situation and make the most of it. However, I have started a specific COVID-related podcast that you can listen to. It is called The Coronavirus Effect: Where Do We Grow From Here? On it, I talk to industry experts about the impact that it has on their industry and what it means for the future and the lessons that we can learn. I will try to get more relevant content onto this podcast here as well, but for now, if you want some nice, calm audio that takes a step back from the news and the panic around the situation and instead calmly examines what it means, then that might be the podcast for you. Again, that's the Coronavirus Effect podcast. So on that, enjoy this episode. And do note that it was recorded before coronavirus existed, so we won't mention it at all, but it just happens to be highly relevant right now. Do you experience stress or have anxiety, or maybe chronic pain, or have trouble sleeping at least once a week? Well, you're not alone. Many of us do. Personally, I do go through phases of not sleeping very well and suffer from chronic pain from where I shattered my femur. So I was searching for anything that would help and discovered Feels. What is Feels? It's a premium CBD delivered directly to your door. And what does it do? It naturally helps reduce stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. So now I kind of sleep a bit better. It's really easy to take. You place a few drops of Feels under your tongue and you feel different within minutes. It can take a while to find the right dose, and everyone's dose is different, so you could leave some room to experiment over the course of a week. But what's really great is that they have a human support hotline, so you can talk to a real human about your experience and have some guidance. And remember, it's quite natural, so it'll help you feel better without any high or hangover or addictions. They also have a nice membership option, which lets you join a community and get Feels delivered to your doorstep every month, and you can save money on every order and pause your subscription. In summary, Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. So you can become a member by going to feels.com/growth, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's F-E-A-L-S, feels.com/growth to become a member and get 50% off automatically from your first order with free shipping. feels.com/growth. Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today I have Caitlin Ugolik Phillips with me. She is a journalist and editor living in North Carolina, and she's written a brilliant book called The Future of Feeling: Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World, which I've really, really enjoyed. And you've also done writing for Vice, Lifehacker, and General Health, and you've been really busy. So I'm very pleased to be talking to you today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Cool. So I'd like to start by just getting to know the guest a little bit. So could you just give me your life summary in 3 minutes, please?
I will do my best. I was born in Connecticut and lived there until I was about 9. My family moved to North Carolina, where I grew up, went to school. For the most part, I went to college at Elon University, which most people have probably not heard of. It's a small private school here in North Carolina. And then I graduated from college basically into the recession, the Great Recession, as we call it, in 2009. And so I had a job in radio for about a year here in Raleigh, but wasn't really what I wanted to do. I missed writing and there were basically no journalism jobs. That was my major. And so I went to grad school because that's what we all did. I moved to New York City and went to the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. And then that was a great experience. It got me to New York. And then after that, I started my career. So I worked as a legal journalist for a while. And then I transitioned to financial journalism. Really, I was interested in writing about health and psychology and people. But again, it was still kind of hard to find jobs doing what you actually wanted to do in journalism. But then around 2014, I decided that I wanted to write this book and that in order to do that, I was going to need to have kind of a different job situation. I need a job that was a little less crazy, had less deadlines. So I transitioned to doing nonprofit communications work, which has mostly been writing and editing for nonprofit organizations. So a law school in Brooklyn. And then my husband and I moved back to North Carolina a couple years ago. And I took a job at a health policy think tank here. And so I do a bunch of editing for them. And then that has kind of freed up the creative part of my brain to work on this book. And then hopefully, you know, some new projects coming down the line soon. I think that covers most things. I have a cat named Lily and yeah, I live here in Raleigh, North Carolina now. And that's about my life.
Cool. Well, thanks. Interesting to hear. Cause I, yeah, it's nice to have people get to where they got because you just think people are kind of as they are really. Sounds like you really had to be quite motivated on your general mission to write about what you want to write about to get there.
Definitely.
They just get given to you exactly. Yeah, it's quite interesting. So what did you learn in the radio? Because that's kind of different. Was there any useful lessons from that?
Yeah, that was an interesting job because I was essentially just a booker. Like I would book people onto shows, but occasionally on the weekends or an early morning when someone, you know, was sick or couldn't come in, I would get to do the news on the radio live. And it kind of gave me a taste for what that might be like. And you know, that I might want to do that later on in life, but it also gave me a chance to do a different kind of writing. You know, when you have to write for the radio, it's a lot more short, punchy, concise than the longer form kind of writing I had been used to. So that was useful. And they also gave me the opportunity. I wanted to do like a short radio documentary. So they were like, sure, why not? We'll air it on a Sunday when no one's listening. And so I made a 6-minute radio documentary about an American Indian tribe in North Carolina who was looking to get federal recognition so that they could get the benefit that come with that. And they did air it on a Sunday when no one was listening, but that was still exciting and gave me, you know, a good experience.
Cool. I think that helped a lot for then writing your book, trying to get different people to interview and talk about their stories.
Oh yeah. That job and then all the jobs I had in New York, you know, when I was a legal journalist, I would interview, you know, the people writing the complaint, the people, you know, ask for comment from people who, you know, were being accused of different things. It was civil litigation. So it wasn't like, you know, murder and mayhem, but mostly business related stuff. But yeah, I did a lot of interviewing there. And then at the financial magazine I worked at, I wrote a lot of profiles of people and some features. So that involved, you know, a lot of interviewing, research, fact checking. So I definitely was prepared over the years for the project that the book would be.
Cool. And so from your years of interviewing people, what were your favorite techniques to help get people to open up and trust you?
That's a good question. I think one of the best techniques is to do it in person, which is way harder than it sounds, especially when you have a deadline every day or every few days. Most interviews happen on the phone. And if you can look someone in the eye and, you know, have a little bit of a rapport, it definitely makes a difference. But if you have to do it on the phone, I felt like, you know, obviously asking open-ended questions, not yes or no questions. And sometimes just working with the silence, like if things are quiet for a couple seconds, not necessarily jumping in and kind of hoping that the person you're interviewing will be the one to think, okay, how can I fill this silence? And then maybe say something interesting. And that's hard for me. I hate awkward silences, but they can be really good for journalism.
Yes. You like a good silence. Just wondering, are there any memorable lessons that you had from like something a guest maybe told you that was like, wow, this is, you shifted my perspective about things
in my interview. Like from something I wrote or in an interview?
Yeah, from an interview, as if someone told you.
There have definitely been a few times where I've told people I'm interviewing about the results of other reporting that I've done while working on the same story that I'm interviewing them from. And they've said like, oh, I had no idea about that, you know, piece of research, or I've never heard that perspective before. Sometimes it was something I would say based on information that I'd pulled together and just kind of an idea that I'd formulated. But sometimes it's, you know, oh, when I interviewed this person 2 days ago, they said this. And then the person I'm interviewing now kind of going like, huh, that's a new idea. That happens a lot when I'm interviewing people who are researchers or scientists, because I think they can get kind of siloed into their own work because, you know, it takes up a lot of time. It's kind of consuming. And sometimes they, you know, to have a second to be like, oh, what's someone else in this field thinking about? I don't think they always have the time to have those conversations. So occasionally that'll happen when I'm doing an interview.
Yeah, it's a bit of a sort of weakness almost of going super deep into one subject means you kind of can't necessarily be knowledgeable in many other things, which is often where a lot of the best ideas come from, is in applying other skills to a current problem.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. Or just collaborating with other people.
Yeah, you get so many ideas from things. As in, I've been really enjoying reading books with a friend and just sort of talking about them each week and just seeing other people's perspectives and what they get from them is just, you learn twice as much, if not more, from like doing that.
Yeah, definitely. I actually started a book club, but it's a different type of book club. It's a bring your own book club. And the idea is that I had a hard time getting a group of friends to all agree to read the same book. So I thought, why don't we all just read whatever we want, but then we can come together and essentially make the case to each other for why they should read or not read what we've been reading. So our first meeting is this weekend. We'll see if it actually works.
Yeah. That's nice. Because it still gives you the chance to like digest it a bit more and think about how you'll talk about it, which is a lot of the benefit. And then explaining it to other people.
If you're convinced and you read the book someone recommended and then you have a completely different experience, you already know there's someone you can talk to about it.
Yeah. And still, when you're doing that, people can ask you questions about what it was you thought and challenge your views that you're saying, oh, this is with this way. And they can be like, oh, but what about this? And yeah, cool. I'm very pleased to hear this. I just think there's so much benefit from talking about these things. I'm building an app currently to let you listen to podcasts and books at the same time as your mates, or like in sync.
Oh,
so that like
cool.
It would kind of prioritize your playlist. Let's say I listen to a few podcasts the same as a different friend. When he listens to one of those podcasts, it will just instantly put that podcast to the top of my playlist. So I'll listen to it like on the same day as he has, and we can both talk about what we just learned. And
that's really cool.
Why doesn't that exist? So coming soon.
That's where the best ideas come from, I think, is you think, oh, I wish I had this book to read, or I wish I had this app, I wish I had this thing, and then you make it. I've been thinking about, so I'm about to go on vacation, as I told you before we started recording, and the last time I went on vacation, I was putting my out of office message in, and then I was thinking, for my personal email, I really wish there was something, and maybe there is, but I couldn't find one, where you could gather all of the emails that come in while you're away, and then it would sort of somehow sort through the most important things, and I'm talking about like the news, like newsletters that I get every single day at 6 a.m. and kind of like prioritize them, but keep them separate from the rest of the inbox so that when I came back, I could decide if I wanted to look at them or not instead of having 500 emails. To delete.
Yeah.
I don't think that exists, but.
Yeah, but there's a bit of like separation. You can just sort of segregate out newsletters and stuff. You can't really say which ones are more important or
right.
Why. Or if you get like a daily news one, delete all the old ones because if you only really want like the most recent one perhaps or something, it's nothing like that. But it could be interesting. As part of my experimentations with tech stuff, deleted all of my newsletters ever, which took like a process of over a month of just unsubscribing every single time. I mean, some of my newsletters were really good. And I didn't think I had like that much of a problem because I thought, okay, yeah, I've only got like 5 or 6 that I sort of quite like, and there's a few others that I should probably get rid of. And I thought I'd been unsubscribing from things, and I had like almost 200 newsletters. Like,
oh wow!
I recorded that each one, and I thought I was quite good. Like my friends were like, "Oh Sam, you got a clean email. You're not too bad." And yeah, it was really, really like enlightening to see just how bad my problem was. And I haven't subscribed to any since, even though I thought that I would. Like, you know, I follow some people who just read really interesting content and stuff. But it just having those newsletters, it just sends me onto links to just go on like mindless surfing of things, and some of it's interesting stuff, but I don't need to be going into these things. And yeah, it just keeps my headspace so much better. And
yeah,
I
did something similar recently, and one of the things I realized was that I was really getting the same information from a lot of them. Like I get 3 or 4 different, you know, what's the top news of today emails, and they all essentially say the same thing. I don't need all of them. And then the other problem is I'm one of those people who will click on all these links of things that seem remotely interesting. And then I have a million tabs open in my browser and then I feel like I have to read them all and I don't.
Yeah, I deleted Pocket as well because I was forever like putting things to Pocket, which meant that like I could always be productive with my time. There was always great content to be reading on Pocket, but I was constantly anxious and I always was doing stuff when I didn't need to be. And So I don't read as much interesting blogs from the internet as I used to, but like I have time to myself to think sometimes when I'm standing in a queue. I just sort of stand and think, and sometimes I come up with jokes for my comedy set, or sometimes I think about new app ideas, and sometimes I just waste my half an hour being chill or whatever. It doesn't really matter. Nice to have your brain space for yourself. It's like I've been talking about, if you're just constantly like listening to podcasts or reading other people's thoughts, like your entire brain is only ever listening to other people's thoughts. Like you're never listening to any of your own. Like you need to learn how to listen to your own thoughts if you want to be creative.
This is exactly what I've been thinking about, especially with regard to Instagram and Twitter, because I realized that same pull that you're talking about to, you know, oh, I need to do something with my time, so I'm going to open Pocket and read something. Even though looking at Instagram and Twitter, you could say objectively it's not productive, I feel like they're built to make you have that same feeling, like, oh, I'm a little bit bored, let me open these apps. And then I started to realize, especially like as someone who's already a pretty anxious person, that I was just constantly filling my head, you know, from the minute I wake up until I go to sleep with other people's ideas about things. And I kind of realized I don't need that. Like being open to other people's thoughts, being curious, or being empathetic to what other people are going through, I don't think we're meant to do that 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, having set times of the day where you open yourself up to that, having boundaries, and this is something else that I've written about recently, is how to have healthier digital boundaries, especially for people who do struggle with mental illness. I think that there's this paradox happening, especially on Instagram, I've noticed, and on Twitter a little bit, where people who struggle with mental illness are really drawn to use these platforms to connect with other people in like a safe way and to share their experiences and help validate others and, you know, in some cases just find community. But there needs to be limits. We're not great at putting limits on ourselves and boundaries of, you know, I'll talk about this aspect of my life, but then I'm not required to respond to every reply. Or, you know, just because I've been vulnerable in this way doesn't mean that you can send me a DM at 2 a.m. asking a question and expect an answer. That sort of, like, that whole issue is kind of part of the problem that I feel like, the empathy problem that I feel like I identified a few years ago, where it wasn't just that people are mean to each other on the internet. It was this kind of like entitlement to each other's time and to be able to access each other's thoughts and feelings and experiences whenever we want, because that's what these platforms were built for. And I think we're starting to feel the negative effects of that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've been thinking about sort of from like an evolutionary psychology perspective. If you think about how we started becoming obese, we evolved to not be in a place where we had like excess abundance of food the whole time. So on any given day, you should eat more than you need for that day because of that's not natural, and so you make the most of it. And it's the same with like these things that grab our attention. We're designed to pay attention to this kind of stuff because it's more important than our normal environment, which is kind of boring and gives us this time for our headspace and think to ourselves because there's nothing going on. And so we always prioritize these things because we used to have all this time for ourselves that we now just don't have. Because of we automatically prioritize this new thing that is now becoming unhealthy to have too much of it. We never have the time that we used to just have abundance of to be ourselves.
Yeah. There's this book written by, I don't know if you're familiar with Manoush Zomorodi.
I have heard of her. Yeah, she runs Hidden Brain podcast.
No, she was doing a podcast.
Or is that a different podcast?
That's a different podcast. She was doing Note to Self, but now she's actually taking over the TED Radio Hour. But she wrote a book called Bored and Brilliant, and it includes a lot of this research about how being bored is actually so good for your creativity and your productivity and your happiness. If you just cultivate these moments like you were talking about, like you're standing in line for something and instead of pulling out your phone, just look around and sit with your thoughts. And it's really hard. It's like harder than, you know, a lot of us would admit.
So it doesn't give you instant like reward gratification.
And you have to sit with your own thoughts and you have to, the big thing is that you have to address or acknowledge acknowledge the things that you're trying to avoid by opening up the apps. And that's something that I actually did a talk last night about digital wellness and kind of well-being. And one of the things, this is a cognitive behavioral therapy thing, but you know, when you're constantly feeling pulled to do something, if you have an urge, you know, to check Instagram or whether it's some other kind of habit that doesn't feel healthy, often it's because, you know, you're trying to soothe yourself. It's like a self-soothing thing. And so finding out what you're trying to soothe yourself about and addressing that instead is probably healthier, but it can be really hard because it's usually not an easy thing. It's not as easy as opening Instagram. It's like, oh, maybe I need to go to therapy, or maybe it's, I need to go for a walk, or, you know, but I think that's kind of the thing that a lot of us don't want to deal with. We don't want to sit with our own thoughts.
Yeah, definitely. And when you're trying to do something useful, like sit and do 2 hours of writing, it seems like a big scary thing. You don't know how to instantly sort of break into this thing and say, you're like, oh, well, instantly I can start feeling productive by just going onto Instagram, or like I've got some messages I might need to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or if you do get stuck because you're halfway through your thing, you're writing, you're like, oh, I can just send some messages because that would be useful. And then you waste your whole day just in email, not really doing anything.
Yeah. So it's debatable. This also brings up an issue about our constant need to feel productive and whether that's healthy. And I'm really excited about this new book that's coming out from Ann Helen Peterson. It's called Can't Even. And it's about the millennial generation and burnout and kind of this idea of productivity above all else. And, you know, you're not worthy as a human unless you're constantly busy. And I think the social technology has a place in that because, like you just said, it kind of fills that productivity need when you're done with work for the day or you need a distraction, and you'll feel guilty if you go for a walk or do something, quote, unproductive. But if you're consuming information, it feels like you're doing something.
Yeah, I think I like it. What was the name of the book again?
It's called Can't Even, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. I don't think it's out yet, but I think you can pre-order it. It might be a good companion to The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World.
Yeah, we should go and discuss that directly, I guess, now. But no, that's really what my head speech is about. I'm part of it.
That's great. Yeah, I can't wait to hear it.
Cool. Nice. But yeah, back to your book, Future Feelings. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I read it 2 months ago, so you know when you read something, you're like, it's really in your brain, and then you can't quite remember all the specifics. But you can sort of maybe highlight some of the most interesting points.
Sure. Yeah, I'm glad that you read it 2 months ago and you're still thinking about it. That was the goal, to just get people kind of thinking about these things. So quickly, I talked a little bit about kind of how I got the idea for this. I was noticing and experiencing all of these things on social media in particular, where I felt like empathy, there just wasn't room on these platforms to really express empathy or feel empathy for the people that you're talking to, especially when you're talking about kind of heavy things, which a lot of us, at least in my circle, were, in part because we grew up doing that from MySpace and LiveJournal. I don't know if people remember LiveJournal, the online blogging thing, and, you know, then Facebook and all these things, that was just kind of our public square. And so it felt obvious to talk about big issues like police violence or mental illness or things like that. But I, you know, realized that there are also drawbacks and potential dangers of having those conversations in places like social media, because it's not built to really make room for empathy. But so I was doing some research and reporting for my job at the time on health technology and starting to realize how much more integrated technology would be getting into our lives in the near future, that we're only moving forward in that way. And I wanted to read a book about people who were kind of attempting to safeguard empathy and our ability for human connection, as, you know, is anyone thinking about keeping us all from becoming robots, essentially? And I could not find that book, so I decided to write it. What the book essentially is, it kind of lays out the issue that, you know, there's a little bit of actual evidence that empathy is in decline. Loneliness, anxiety, and depression are on the rise. It's hard to tie these things directly to technology, but it's obvious that there are correlations there. And anecdotally, a lot of people report, you know, that they get that dopamine hit when they get a notification or scroll, but then afterwards they feel kind of depressed or anxious because they're comparing themselves to their friends, or they saw something that upset them, or experienced a lot of the other things that we just talked about. So the book kind of lays out the issue but then gets into different ways that developers and entrepreneurs are trying to use technology to help fix these problems. So in some cases, it's about, you know, using tech to help build empathy. So there's a lot of examples of games and apps for kids. There's one that I really like called Tiny Bop Homes, and it's just an app on like an iPad, and kids can explore these recreated homes of people in different parts of the world and kind of get a sense of what it's like to live someone else's life. And there's a great story of this girl who, I think she was from Yemen, and she was a little girl and she was really embarrassed to talk about, you know, where she was from because her classmates didn't understand it. You know, they thought it was weird. And then their class played this game and there was a home from Yemen in the game. That was one of the options. And suddenly she felt like, you know, she could talk about where she was from and she felt more comfortable and people were asking her kind questions instead of making fun of her. And it's a little thing, but that can have a big impact on a kid. So things like that. And then the other half of the book is focused more on using empathy to create technology. So sort of having empathy for the end user, not just from a design perspective, which is already a well-established practice, but, you know, from a life perspective. Like, for example, imagine if Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, all those guys imagined like, hey, what if someday someone uses our platforms to try and sway an election or to, you know, gang up on a person and run them out of their town because they talked about feminism on Twitter, or just kind of imagining potential negative outcomes based on experiences that are not yours. And so then I kind of tie things up with, you know, a lot of the people that I interviewed are from a more diverse set of experiences than the people who created a lot of the tech we use now. So I'm pretty hopeful that the next wave of things is already being built with a little bit more empathy for just various different types of perspectives and experiences that people might have.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks. That's kind of relates to sort of some of the core things I want to do with like the app that I'm building. But yeah, it is really interesting the way people sort of think about just the very surface level behaviors of what they're creating with their apps. And literally just like, okay, how do I get people to watch the screen and do things? They don't really think about like the lifestyle that it creates and like the whole, like what it does to you at a deeper level, which has resulted in some major problems. And if you're just sort of trying to get someone's attention, like that's not necessarily good because people pay attention to the scary things and like the stuff that sort of
the addictive things and dramatic things. Yeah. And one thing that I try and say in every interview about the book too is that a lot of times people will try and get me to talk about how tech is evil and how we should not use these things anymore and throw your phone off a bridge. And like, I really don't think that's necessary or realistic. I think it makes a lot more sense to try to improve our relationships with these things and make all of this better. Because as I said, people who are in their 30s and younger, this is the life that we know. And I think a lot of us don't necessarily want to throw it all away, but kind of find a way to sustain the good parts of social technology, connection with people, the convenience of other kinds of tech, like smartphones, smartwatches, et cetera. Mm. And a lot of kids that I've talked to kind of really do understand that the way that a lot of them and their parents use tech right now isn't sustainable. And they don't want to not have a phone. They want to learn or create ways of making it better, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, definitely. It's a hard one because when you kind of highlight all these problems, it's sort of like, oh, this is just like a bad thing. But then it's not really very useful because it doesn't really give any practical steps. The same with like with climate change, and you just talk about all these problems, but it's not, we can't really just stop the way that we're doing things. Like we could have inherently kind of stuck in what we've got. We kind of need to improve how we do stuff that still lets us.
Right. And also with climate change, that's a great analogy because I also think about the connection with climate change in that a lot of people feel like everything is so terrible. There's nothing we can do. So why bother? And I think the same kind of thing happens with, you know, our eventual tech dystopia. And I think in both cases, we kind of need to push against that idea.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely just start taking the first steps and go on the journey to be in a better world. But yeah, it's just annoying when some people kind of, well, it's not annoying, but the people that just do throw the whole thing out the window and, you know, just go and live in the middle of nowhere in the woods forever. And like, that's great, but like, you're never going to change the world by doing that.
Yeah, I mean, it works for some people. I do like to remind folks that the guy who lived on Walden Pond brought his laundry home to his mom's house, allegedly. So... Even Thoreau didn't really 100% seclude himself from modern life.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so in terms of writing your book, what were the difficulties you encountered?
That's a good question. Probably the biggest difficulty for me personally was that I was working full-time while writing the book. That just made it a lot harder to take the time to research things and make trips and do interviews. But aside from that, people talk a lot about imposter syndrome, and I feel like at this point, that phrase kind of just makes people roll their eyes. But genuinely convincing myself that the people who were talking to me and taking me seriously and agreed to publish my book and pay me for it were not crazy and I should trust them and thereby trust myself that I knew what I was doing, even when, you know, it gets to the point where you have a bunch of disjointed pages and index cards and you're trying to figure out the structure and kind of asking yourself, why am I doing this to myself and who thought I could do it? That was a really hard part, but it did teach me that I can survive it, I guess. So I don't know. A lot of people tell me that the second book is easier just because you already know you can write a book, but I still think there's always going to be that part where you are surrounded by scraps of paper on the floor, crying, wondering how you're ever going to make it all fit together and make sense. On the flip side, the best part is when you are reading some research paper or notes from some interview or some article and you suddenly make a connection and realize that you know where two pieces fit together and you already have those pieces and you don't need to do 10 more years of work. Like your brain is telling you, you actually like already have something that makes sense. That is a euphoric feeling.
Yeah, I can totally relate from my own writing of, yeah, just sort of having ideas that seem quite sort of logical and then starting on them, having like more ideas and tangents, just going off into this like weird like maze of like self-constructed puzzles. And but also it's kind of similar to maybe like programming as well, when you're kind of trying to write like really difficult algorithms and things and just trying to get your head into stuff and you end up like making these weird mazes of things you need to do, but then kind of having connections of stuff you've already written and you can put together, like, ah, so satisfying.
I mean, without that, no one would ever finish anything except for the most determined people, because otherwise it's just horrible.
Yeah. So did you get a lot of help from editors and other people?
Not until, well, okay. So actually at the beginning of the process, I was still living in New York and I was in a writing group that met in person once a week, which is honestly like
that
a unicorn, beautiful situation that might never happen to me again.
But I want
they
that.
they really helped me craft the, well, first of all, they helped a lot with the imposter syndrome thing of like, you know, no, we actually think this is a good idea and you should do it. They helped a lot with the crafting of the proposal. So I would share pieces of the sample chapters and things like that with them and just discuss. And they were just all fellow writers. Some of them were editors too. But so that was really helpful. And then once I got an agent, she helped me edit the proposal a little bit more to make it more attractive to potential publishers. But it was really a matter of kind of like framing the issue as opposed to line editing scenes in the chapters. Mm. And then, of course, once I got the publisher to sign on, I had a long period of just writing, like 6 or 7 months. And then there were several rounds of editing with my editor. And then there was a fact-checking process. There was a legal review to make sure I wasn't, you know, slandering anyone. Then there was copy editing. Yeah. So there was a lot of editing, but in the creation part, I was kind of on my own.
Yeah. Interesting. Cool. Yeah, I was going to ask, like, how did you get a publisher? So I guess it was the stuff you've described. Was there any other things that you didn't mention?
So like when people say, oh, my agent, oh, my editor, publisher, whatever, it can kind of feel like, oh, wow, this person has everything figured out and they're so smart. I can't do that. I literally Googled how to find an agent and asked a few people for suggestions. And I sent query emails just with information about myself and the book I was writing and the draft proposal to probably 12 different agents who I had researched and knew that they would be interested at least in the genre and the topic. And I had a couple that were interested and one really wanted me to kind of make it something a little different than it was. And I wasn't comfortable with the direction she wanted me to take it. And then the other thought it was great in the direction it was going. And so she and I decided to work together. And then her job was to send the proposal and her own email to her contacts in the publishing industry and see what publisher publisher wanted to buy the book. So with nonfiction, a lot of people don't know, with nonfiction, you write a proposal and that's what you sell. Mm. And that's what a publisher agrees to pay you an advance for. And then you finish the book. And in fiction, for the most part, you have to finish the book first. You have to write the whole manuscript and then sell that. So both are difficult in their own ways. So the publisher I ended up with, or the editor that I ended up working with, I had actually met her before I started the whole process. And she had said, you know, I might be interested once you have a proposal and an agent, come back to me. And it actually worked out. But then the rest of the work was remote because I was down here in North Carolina and there in New York. And we did a lot of emailing, but it was a really educational experience. And I feel like it's like the way people talk about childbirth sometimes, where they're like, you know, it's like miserable and horrible and you hate it. And then as soon as it's over, you're like, I could do that again, maybe. That's kind of how I'm feeling right now about this book. And I'm like, maybe I should give myself a little bit of a break.
Yeah. Listen, like we said about the need to always be productive, maybe you can just enjoy yourself a little bit. But maybe you enjoy the pain and the writing and stuff and finding the challenge. Who knows? But it does sound like overall, it was a very, very worthwhile experience.
Yes, for sure.
Learned lots. So I'm sure the chance to teach yourself lots more and learn more things, writing more books would be useful.
Yeah. I don't recommend trying to write a book about something you're not super passionate about, because you will even get bored by things you're super passionate about when you have to think about them constantly for 4 years in a row. So you have to be really sure that it's something you want to spend a lot of time on.
That sounds like very good advice now that you've said that. Thanks. Yeah, I have loads of ideas for books, but sure, a lot of them would be like, actually, after a week, I'd be kind of like, well, the book isn't done yet. So
yep. I'm on
board. Maybe this should have just been a blog post. Which is a, yeah. You do a lot of...
Not all of us can write multiple books a year like Stephen King.
Yeah. Do you think you'll be able to write much faster now? Or do you think you always want to do something that's like very intensive in terms of lots of fact checking and multiple ideas going on?
Yeah, I think... I don't know. Right now, I'm sort of pulled to do something that's a little bit different and might be more fun in terms of fiction. But I also know that once I really get into the weeds of that, it's going to be just as difficult and just in a different way. But then I also have a few nonfiction ideas, and it's just a matter of, do I actually have the time to devote to it? And, you know, mentally, am I prepared to do that again?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the same with that, like, after my first business. So I've started other businesses since then, but always kind of apprehensively and just sort of like called like dating ideas to see if it's something that I'd really want to do, and worked out like what the next steps would be to make it successful, and been like, yeah, I don't really feel putting myself like 3 years of doing that before like this idea gets to being like really successful. And so yeah, I've started lots of projects and stopped them. So I've been like, yeah, not too interested in doing this, as I thought.
Yeah, but it's good to give yourself the time to do that.
Yeah,
and not feel like, oh, I have this idea. I may never have another good idea again. And this goes back to the beginning of our conversation, where you need to turn things off sometimes and sit with your thoughts and be a little bit bored, and so in order to make the space in your brain to date different ideas.
Yeah, it's pretty essential to any kind of success. Hard one. So yeah, just as we're running up, are there any sort of major take-home tips that you'd advise to listeners out here?
I like to tell people that I hope that what the book does is just get people to think a little bit more intentionally about how they use technology and why they use technology and kind of how it affects them and other people. And I encourage folks to just kind of be more intentional when using platforms, and especially when interacting with other people. So be observant of kind of how you feel when you have this urge to pick up your phone, but then also try and train yourself to maybe pause for a second before responding to a comment that pissed you off, or before going into an anxiety spiral about a headline you read. Just kind of trying to train yourself to take a moment to examine what's going on and like be a little more intentional. I think that's kind of the place to start. And then, you know, if you want to be really ambitious, complaining and sending emails and letters and, you know, campaigns to the big tech companies to have a little more empathy and put that into practice, or creating your own more empathy inclusive technology, is kind of like leveling up in that.
Okay. Would you say that from your book, I really remember reading some quite nice examples about how we miss empathy, as in others misinterpret us, or we don't feel empathetic to others. And I don't feel that maybe we've mentioned that too much in the podcast. So I thought maybe you might have a good example of what you mean by that size system, alluding to our loss of empathy when we're using tech.
Can you clarify? What do you mean we miss empathy?
As in, you've outlined the fact that we lack empathy when we're using technology to others, when we're like in our social media sometimes, and that that can be bad for us, or that others can affect us because they haven't used empathy. And like, that's just, it's just like some words, it's a concept. It's not something that's like solidified in my my mind without hearing a story by what you mean.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah, sure. The example that I open the book with is one from 2014 where it kind of encapsulates a little bit of this, I think. So I was on Facebook and talking to a bunch of friends about the police shooting death of Michael Brown, who was a young Black man in Ferguson, Missouri. And the way that he was killed and the kind of outcry from his community after that became national and maybe global, I don't know, news about this problem of police brutality. And a lot of people were talking about it and trying to figure out what had happened. And I and a lot of my friends were really kind of, you know, socially minded and concerned and posting about things and kind of like having this community conversation on Facebook. And suddenly I had posted something about my concern about, you know, what's going on at this police force? Why did this happen? And someone that I had gone to high school with, who I hadn't talked to since high school, sent me a direct message and was kind of like, you really have no right to be talking about this at all. Can't judge police officers because you aren't one and I am. So let me show you what it's really like. And it was kind of this like, it's kind of strange how you can feel like your private messages on these platforms are kind of like a very vulnerable private space. And if someone comes in there without permission, you kind of feel barged in on, even though it's a piece of technology that you can turn off. That like really upset me at the time. And at the time I remember thinking, you know, like, where is this guy's empathy for this situation, that this horrible thing that happened? But then later I kind of realized I was being very selective about my empathy as well. I did not think at the time, I didn't think until later that like, okay, maybe I can understand where he's coming from as a policeman in a different part of the country who has, you know, difficult experiences. Like clearly I struck a nerve and maybe I should find out why. But something about that environment of Facebook and of knee-jerk reactions and of, you know, someone messaging you in your private inbox and things like that, just kind of, and using all caps and things like that, just kind of didn't seem to leave room for empathy. It didn't seem to give enough space to like have a calm, trusting conversation that might lead to actually taking each other's perspectives and learning from each other. So that kind of, I think, was an example in my personal life of something that kind of made me realize, okay, myself included, everyone is kind of just forgetting empathy when trying to talk about big things on these social platforms. And is there anything we can do about that? Or is that just going to be how it is because we're all hiding behind keyboards?
Thanks for explaining. That's that really helps add a dimension of perspective for everything you're explaining. And good choice on starting the book with that. I think it really helped make your point. And
oh, it made some people very angry. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know
if you've read the Amazon reviews, but some people are really just didn't get past that and kind of upset that I mentioned the all caps.
Yeah.
For some reason, people are upset by that. They're, you know, one person said, don't read this book. It's just like a how-to guide for liberal brainwashing. And I'm like, maybe I shouldn't read the reviews.
Yeah, follow your advice and share from these things a bit, definitely. I mean, it's good to be polarizing in some way so you get like the right people, but not if you wanted to have everyone read it.
Like nothing is going to be for everyone, right?
Yeah.
So it's just kind of frustrating, like you said, when people misinterpret what you
definitely
mean.
And you're trying to highlight that you didn't have enough empathy and you want more,
I have it and no one else does.
Definitely. That's awkward. So do you think you would change it if you were rewriting it then?
I don't think so. I think I might slow it down and add more context, not just to that part, but to the whole book. Yeah. I think I definitely suffered a little bit from, you know, let me get this done because I don't even really know if I can do it or if I'm ever going to be able to do it again. So, you know, I was careful and fact checked and all of that. And I made sure everything was accurate, but I don't know if I kind of gave it the space it could have used to be a little bit more of a thoughtful book. But I think you'd be hard pressed to find an author who doesn't think they could have done something differently.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Always. So, yeah, I'm glad that you got it out. I still really like it. I wouldn't complain at all.
Yeah, thank you for reading it. I really appreciate it.
Oh, not at all. Thanks for writing it and spending 4 years following your interests. It's a big move. Very glad that you did this. Do you feel that you had any issues as a woman in writing this that maybe it would have been easier as a man or anything, just on the subject of feminism and things?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I actually think that people would have been a little more surprised to have a male reporter calling them, asking them about empathy. empathy and not necessarily, you know, discriminated or anything. But I think that our culture, and this is maybe part of the reason that empathy isn't part of the foundation of a lot of the tech we use, because a lot of it is made by men, and our culture, at least Western culture, doesn't prize quote unquote soft skills like empathy in men or encourage them in the same way that it does in women. So in that way, I actually think it might have been easier for me to take on this topic in particular, because it's kind of expected for a woman to care about something like this. And then I also was really intentional about who I interviewed and who I talked to. And so that meant that there was, you know, I talked to a lot of women in addition to men. Sometimes when you report on tech, you can definitely run into a little bit of sexism. But I think that because I was writing about research and I was writing about developers of new tech that were caring about empathy, and a lot of them were women and people of color and all different kinds of people, I didn't really struggle in that way. That's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought about that. And I really do think that because, I mean, if I had tried to write a book about tech that didn't focus on soft skills, maybe it would have been different. But I think I might have actually had an advantage in this case.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. Certainly do agree that it sort of makes sense. Like, it kind of conforms to what you expect from society, that it would be more coming from a woman to be talking about empathy and why this is actually something to focus on. Mm-hmm. So not necessarily if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's
interesting to think about though.
What about like confidence and stuff? Did you feel ready? Do you think like you had more of your feelings of imposter syndrome due to being a woman at all?
So I actually think that everyone feels imposter syndrome. I think women are more conditioned to think that it's real and to actually be hesitant to do things. But my whole life, I've kind of refused, just at a personal level, to not do something just because I'm afraid, which most of the time has worked out in my favor. But there is definitely a gendered element of imposter syndrome that it's just all about conditioning. Kind of like, I believe, you know, it's more about how we grow up and are taught to think about ourselves in the world than about any, you know, like innate ability or anything like that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. 100%. I think, you know, from what I've discussed with people, some women feel a bit more like they have to seek out acceptance first before they do something, which can limit what you do, perhaps. I'm not sure.
Well, I think that I benefit from this kind of like weird idea of blindness where when I want to do something, I'm kind of like I think I feel that acceptance too late or like later than a lot of women do. Like, I decide I want to do something, and so I approach doing it and I start the process, and then I'm like, oh God, what did I get myself into? Am I actually qualified to do this? Well, what's going to happen? But by then it's too late and I have to forge ahead, you know?
Yeah, that's really great. Not sure. I think I just sort of have more of an appeal to things that I'm not supposed to usually do, like the things that I know that I'm going to find difficult or that people don't expect me to do. I sort of feel like more of a need to prove myself, which is maybe like a manly thing of like, oh, you don't think I'm good at this? Well, let me show you. Or if that's just weird curiosity to see if I can be good at things, I don't know. But yeah, I definitely have like a similar sort of line as to what I shouldn't be good at, perhaps.
Yeah, humans are weird.
We really are. Which is another thing of the whole technology is sort of ever increasingly amazing. It's kind of, as you think about like what humans are and how crap we are at stuff, it's like, well, what is the point of humans exactly, and what are we like aiming for in the long run?
And that's when you're like, this is uncomfortable, let me scroll Instagram.
Yeah, definitely. It's a bit of a big like topic to go into.
Maybe the next podcast.
Yeah, sure. We can become a bit wiser with these things first. Definitely. Okay, so thanks so much for the time. Last few questions. What is one of your earliest ever memories?
Oh, that's a great question. One of my earliest memories is when I lived in Connecticut. So we lived in a small town next to New Haven, which is where Yale is. But we lived in a really small town next to that. And there was a blizzard. And I had to have been maybe 6 or 7. And my grandmother was pulling me and my sister in a wagon to the library. But this is one of those memories that it probably wasn't really a blizzard, but it felt like it to me. Maybe I wasn't in the wagon, maybe I was next to it, but in my mind, that's the memory. Actually, I think we were coming home from the library and I had borrowed Little Women from the library.
It's a good book. That's quite young to be reading.
Well, I was about to say, it was the children's version, from what I recall.
Cool. I was going to say, it's like a kind of a cartoon version of just like simpler words. Nice. And then what is the kindest thing someone's ever done for you?
That is a really hard question.
It can be just a kind thing rather than
that. Yeah, kind. I guess I'll have to do that.
Take the pressure off you.
One somewhat recent thing. So a couple of years ago, the lead singer of my favorite band died from suicide. Scott Hutchison, Frightened Rabbit. You're probably familiar with them, maybe. The UK. Well, no, Scottish band. Anyway, he passed away and that was my favorite band. And I was kind of heartbroken. And I was living here in North Carolina and a bunch of his friends put on a show in New York City just like to celebrate his life and play his songs. And I really really wanted to go. I couldn't get a ticket and I was devastated and whatever. And a friend of mine knew someone who knew someone and he got me a ticket and left it at the door for me. And I went up there and got to see it. And that really meant a lot to me to kind of just like have that once in a lifetime experience with all these other people who were also really touched by this band and their music. And I wouldn't have been able to do it without that friend helping me get a ticket.
That is really nice. Wow, cool. I'm very glad that you have nice friends and that you got to go.
Yeah, it was lovely.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. Is there any last questions you have for me?
I don't think so. This has been a really fun conversation. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, thanks so much for making the time. Yeah, it's been really, really lovely and certainly learned lots.
I guess the only other thing I would say is that if anyone is now, their interest has piqued and they'd like to buy the book, they can go to my website and it has its own website too, thefutureoffeeling.com.
Cool. I really hope they do because it's a very useful book for people who want to become a bit more empathetic and just better at being themselves in this modern world of technology. So thanks so much for writing it and coming on the show to talk about it.
Yeah, thanks.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.